This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So this is what democracy looks like. Most Americans say they like divided government, don't give all the power to one side. So that must mean what's been going on in Washington these past few days is exactly what most people want. Agree? Disagree? Have no opinion? Yes, we especially want to hear if you have no opinion. Speaking of opinions, two new polls out about Virginia's upcoming election. They show one side with a top-heavy lead among registered voters. But the race gets much closer when you look at people who actually intend to vote. What do you suppose that's about? All things political up for grabs this hour. Our Anita Kumar, Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts analysis team here to help. The Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor has agreed to join in, still waiting for a decision from his Republican opponent, as well as a couple of congressmen who've also been invited. But by the end of the hour, we are sure to know. Well, let's find out right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Politics our focus today. And we are on tenderhooks, not because we don't know what our elected representatives are going to do next, although maybe we should be worried about that, but because we don't know yet for sure which ones are going to make themselves available during the next 50 minutes. There's a chance that Congressman Frank Wolf might be able to squeeze in some time, but we'll either be talking with him or about him, since the Virginia Republican is one of the few in his caucus who has taken a view contrary to his GOP colleagues about the government shutdown. Another Republican, the controversial candidate for lieutenant governor, E.W. Jackson, has also not been able to give us a definite answer about his availability. However, his opponent, Democrat Ralph Northam, has said for sure he will be with us in a bit, as long as there are no medical emergencies among the patients that he is seeing in his office at this moment. So, well, we can tell you that the best political analysis team in Virginia is with us. And if you want to speak with them, our call-in line is open at 888-WMRA-TALK. White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar. Public policy guru and political scientist from James Madison University, Bob Roberts. Plus the leader of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson. Hey, team, thanks for definitively showing up today.
Glad to be here. Good to join you.
Okay, so Anita, when's the government going to reopen?
Oh, if I only knew. I don't know. But since the president and the speaker of the House don't know, I don't feel so bad about not knowing.
Yeah, you just ran over to your office in the rain from the White House briefing room.
I did.
Hearing from Press Secretary Carney, and what did he have to say?
He wants the House to vote to reopen the government. Government without any strings attached, without drama and delay, as he said about 10 times. The president's calling for the speaker to call a vote.
But wasn't there some discussion about wiggle room in that briefing a few minutes ago?
Well, that's actually not about the government shutdown per se. This is about the second issue that's looming in the next week or two, which is the Congress also needs to vote to raise the debt ceiling, which essentially allows it to pay its bills. Which is a much bigger deal. So if Congress doesn't do that, then the United States government would default on its obligations. So he was saying that they want what is typically done, which is a bill that would be for 1 year that they could pay the bills. And he was saying, but we'll accept something less. I think people are making a bigger deal about that. There is no actual bill on the floor anywhere for them to consider. So I think they were just saying, we'll take something, give us something.
And the speaker made clear yesterday on ABC that these rebels don't exist. In other words, that if he put a vote to the floor, on the floor, that there would not be a majority of members of the House voting for it. So there seems to be...
He didn't exactly say that.
Yes, he did.
What John Boehner, appearing on This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday, did a couple of things. One, he talked about the current government shutdown and what it would take to get a vote to reopen the government. And then they switched to talk about, as Anita was just saying, what many consider the much more damaging idea of the government defaulting on its bills.
Partially
if the debt
default.
Ceiling is not raised as of about the 17th of this month. So what I think you're referring to, Bob Roberts, is that at one point where Mr. Stephanopoulos asked the speaker, why he didn't just allow there to be a vote in the House, since there are all these reports that all the Democrats would vote to reopen the government, and a number of Republicans would vote for it, too. And in different reports, it's like 20 or 21 Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so that would be a majority of the House. What Boehner said is, we don't have the votes.
Right.
There are not the votes to reopen the government. He didn't really say that it's a myth that there are some Republicans who would vote for it.
I think he clearly implied that he thought that was people's figment of the imagination, that the his loyal Republicans would do such a dastardly thing.
Hey, Bob Gibson, over there in Charlottesville at the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, one of your graduates who is now part of the Republican caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives, representing, I think it's primarily the Tidewater area of Virginia, actually made it big in his career a few days ago when he appeared on The Daily Show.
Scott Ridgel, who represents Norfolk and Virginia Beach and the Tidewater area down there, basically went on record as the only Republican before the shutdown saying we should not tie shutting down the government and a continuing resolution on spending to defunding Obamacare. He was the only member of his caucus prior to the shutdown who said that in a vote on the floor. And the Daily Show, Jon Stewart sent Samantha Bee out to interview Congressman Ridgel, and he withstood the interview of a comic in his office rather well.
Ms. B, in essence, telling him that he was crazy for not supporting the idea that you shut down the government when you don't get something you want.
She baited him, and she even fell off her chair and fake hit her head, but it didn't seem to faze the congressman much.
What's the mood in Washington at this point, Anita Kumar? Is there gnashing of the teeth and rubbing of the knuckles, or do people really think this is not going to be as terrible as the doomsayers say?
Well, I think initially people thought there would be the government shutdown on Tuesday. I just don't think a lot of people, myself included, thought it would last this long. And judging on what the speaker said yesterday in the interview we were just talking about, it sounds like it's going to go on for, I mean, it could go on for another week or two. And I think that a lot of people are just kind of settling in and thinking, okay, well, this isn't going to go away. Employees seem very upset, though. The people that have been furloughed, they are, you know, a lot of them are outside the Capitol and protesting. And I've seen signs on the subway saying, you know, please put me back to work, that kind of thing. So it's kind of dreary and not very positive right now.
So to you listening in, some people say that the benefit of divided government, making sure one political group does not control all the bodies of decision-making, is that it keeps the majority from running roughshod over the minority. So I'm curious, is that your take on what's been going on in Washington of late? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. And actually, whether you want to talk about the national affairs or the upcoming Virginia elections or anything political, we are here to listen at 888-967-2825. And after we listen, we'll probably have a response. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. Dr. Bob Roberts, it has been your contention for months now that if we had a government shutdown, it would almost be impossible for the Republican candidate for governor to win in November.
It would make it much more difficult, and this is why. If you look at the voting behavior of government employees, it's a myth that they all vote Democratic. In fact, government employees vote like the rest of the population. For example, white males tend to vote Republican. That includes government employee white males. And if you've got large numbers of furloughed, for example, males, they're not going to appreciate the fact that they're not going to get paid. Since our Republican gubernatorial nominee, Mr. Cuccielli, has waited till fairly late to condemn or call for the opening of the federal government without Obamacare being slashed, that's not going to bode well for him. If the turnout is decent. If the turnout is not decent, then he can win. But if you've got a reasonable turnout, it makes it very, very difficult in this environment.
Was it both federal government employees as well as defense contractors who ended up being furloughed, or just those who were actually government
employees?
Right
now, we're not clear about how many defense contractors have laid individuals off, because contract years are different.
But there are certainly huge numbers of those in Virginia.
We have 179,000. Anita may have the exact number in terms of federal employees in Virginia. I've heard different numbers, like 179,000 who actually live in Virginia. All those individuals now can collect unemployment insurance from Virginia. So
I was just going to say that it for a couple days they looked okay, and then by the end of the week on Friday, a lot of contractors kind of shared the news. I think that goes back to people didn't really know how long this thing would go on.
And now it looks like it could go on for quite a while?
Well, I mean, the debt ceiling debate that we just referred to, the deadline, if there is one, I'm suspicious of deadlines at this point now, but that's October 17th, which is next week, and I just feel like everything is going to be tied to that now, so I could see this going on for another week or two.
I think the debt ceiling is a bit misunderstood. It's not a full default. It's what we call a partial default, because the federal government still has a lot of revenue coming in. The problem is not enough to cover all their obligations. So what Treasury would have to do is, as of October 17th, is decide who gets paid, or do you pay someone less, or something like that. In other words, that there would be money to pay some people and some businesses, bondholders, whatever. But the question is, we've never had to try to decide who gets paid first. It's like, you know, a business can't pay all their bills at the same time.
But Bob Gibson at the Sorensen Institute, isn't this largely a matter of perception? If you have the economic markets all of a sudden all a jitter about the government not meeting all of its obligations, that does not bode well for the economy in the near future.
No, it doesn't. And polls have shown that Americans in the last few days have had their faith in the economy sinking to new lows in the past 2 years. And if some people can't get paid, if the federal government can't pay some of its bills, it's going to cause a lot of people in the stock market to look at where their 401ks are going, and it's going to cause a lot of people to maybe flee the market or do something else with their money. And it's consumer confidence is one thing, and so is the perception that the government can't pay all its bills.
Right.
I mean, it's very harmful to the economy, and especially here in Virginia, which has more federal government business than any other state.
And the governor has already told all state agencies to submit proposed 4% budget cuts. This was even before the election. Usually hold off those things till after the election.
So, one thing that we're almost absolutely certain of is that out of all the people who've been invited to participate today, the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, Ralph Northam, is going to be with us in a very few minutes here. So I want to get back to this idea of the upcoming November 5th statewide election in Virginia being affected by the government shutdown. Bob, one of the things that you were saying is that if you have all these government workers, including those who would normally think about voting for the Republican candidate, not getting paid, they're going to be angry at the Republican Party for that.
Correct.
Now there's word that they are going to be paid. We don't know when they're going to be paid, but after the government reopens, isn't there decision now that they're going to get back paid?
They'll get paid, but they're not getting paid now. And the question is, if you've got to pay bills now, and you've got mortgages to pay, car payments to pay, and you're not getting paid, you don't know how long it's going to take to get paid, you're going to get angry at somebody. And the question is, who do you get angry at? And Mr. Cuccinelli has waited to a very fairly recently to basically come out against the shutdown. So it's not going to help him any. It may not destroy him. He still may win if the voter turnout is very, very low.
Well, there are a couple of new polls out that talk about who's in what position in voters' minds, and the difference between the total number of registered voters who they would prefer for governor versus the number of people who actually look like they're going to bother to show up for the election. And there's a difference there. We'll get to that. We'll get to the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor who is on the line with us now after we pause for about a 1 minute break. Please stay with us. anything, everything political up for discussion. Our analysis panel on this edition of Virginia Insight, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, former newspaper reporter and now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, as well as from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Departments, Bob Roberts. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and joining us now by phone is the state senator and pediatric neurologist who is the Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam. Dr. Northam, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Well, thank you, Tom, and the rest of the panel for having me on the show this afternoon.
Well, Senator, I am curious. I'm wondering if you've heard many people saying lately that politics could use a good neurologist or even a pediatrician.
Well, I tell you, as you know, there's a lot of overlap between neurology and psychiatry, so hopefully I can help some folks out there.
What are people going to get if they have you as lieutenant governor instead of the other guy, your opponent?
Well, you know, I think what I bring to the table is my experience. And, you know, right now we need someone that can preside over the Senate. Bill Boland has done a great job, but obviously this is going to be his last year. So I have the experience. I've been in the Senate for 6 years. I've made good relationships. My reputation there is for, you know, working with both sides of the aisle. So, you know, I look forward to presiding over the Senate and doing what I can to bring people together. That's what we need now. What's going on in Washington is regrettable. And so we need to work together and do what's in the best interest of Virginia. And that's why I'm there.
Well, I appreciate your effort there, Dr. Northam, to stress the positive. But the other half of my question is, what's the difference between what Virginians will get with you in office versus the other guy?
Well, you know, I'll start with this government shutdown. 2 years ago, my opponent, Mr. Jackson, was chanting at a rally in Washington to either cut it or shut it. And, you know, in the debate the other night in Norfolk, I said, you know, Mr. Jackson, you need to be careful what you ask for, because, you know, that's what we have now. And there are Virginians out there, thousands of them, that are not being paid. They're hurting. They're worried about making their house payment, their car payments, worried about educating their children. So we don't need the divisive, offensive statements that are coming from him. It's not needed in the Senate, and Virginians deserve better.
Senator, I'm confused about the deal that was struck in the legislature over Medicaid. Steve Landis recently was quoted, I think last week, and I believe he's on the commission, saying that it doesn't look like we're going to be able to recommend to expand Medicaid in Virginia for 5 years. His comment caught a lot of individuals off guard because there was a general consensus that the commission would make a recommendation fairly soon about whether to expand Medicaid or not. Can you provide clarification on what that agreement was?
Well, that type of language coming from Delegate Landis is disappointing. You know, there's bipartisan support in the Senate for the Medicaid expansion, and I think what we need to do is look at that as a business model, as an economic driver for Virginia. That will open up coverage to about 400,000 working Virginians. It is literally billions of dollars that if Virginia doesn't take advantage of it, it's money being thrown right out the window to surrounding states like Maryland, Delaware, Florida, New Jersey. And so, you know, that's one of my roles I see as lieutenant governor, to sit down with folks and talk about the dollars and cents of this, not to mention the quality of life for people that need health care coverage. But, you know, this is an important economic driver for Virginia. We can use that money for education, some other things that are needed. I'm certainly an advocate for pre-K education. So I look forward to having discussions with folks like Delegate Landis and saying, you know, let's talk about the dollars and cents, and let's do what's in the best interest of Virginia economically.
Ms. Kumar and Mr. Gibson, I didn't get a chance to ask you this ahead of time, but both of you have interacted in your days as Richmond reporters with Senator Northam. Do either of you have a question for him?
Sure. I'd like to jump in, Senator. People are disgusted with the shutdown, and does this partisan gridlock and shutdown make a strong case for redistricting reform in Virginia especially, so that we don't have all super red or super blue districts, but we have districts where people might actually have a competitive election in November and be able to meet in the middle instead of retreating to their partisan base?
Absolutely, Bob. You know, when I ran in 2007, there were 100 delegate races, 40 Senate races. there were only 17 competitive races, and that's not what democracy is all about. And, you know, each year we have patroned, I've been a co-patron of a nonpartisan redistricting plan in the Commonwealth. It passes in the Senate each year, and then it's defeated in the House. But, you know, this is one of the things, as I've been out on the campaign trail listening to a lot of folks, they are very intent on having nonpartisan redistricting. And I just encourage all of the people out there that are paying attention and voting to ask the candidates, you know, where they stand on that issue. And if they're not in favor of a nonpartisan redistricting plan, I'd tell them to look for someone else.
Dr. Northam, one of the other things that you've been known for in your time in the Virginia State Senate is the number of proposals you've made about ethics reform, and they never got very far. But do you think that there are some people in Virginia politics right now who kind of wish that they had?
Well, you know, one of the things that I have recognized since I've been in the Senate for 6 years, the legislators tend to be a bit more reactionary than visionary, and you know, I have watched the evolution of ethics reform in medicine. I've been practicing since the early 80s, and you know, now we've gotten to the point where providers don't even take as much as a pen, a writing pen, from pharmaceutical companies. We need to see that same evolution in politics. I introduced legislation 2 years ago that would put more teeth in ethics reform. As you just said, it was defeated in the House, but I think we'll see a lot of legislation. As a matter of fact, some has already been filed in the 2014 session. You know, what's happened in Richmond this past year is regrettable. It's been embarrassing for Virginia, and we need to put a stop to it.
Senator Northam, for the past few years now, thanks to the fact that we've had a Republican lieutenant governor presiding over an evenly divided state Senate, Republicans have controlled the Senate. And when that happened, Democrats cried foul and said, hey, this should have been power sharing, since we've got even split between elected senators who are Democrats and elected senators who are Republicans. So if you become the lieutenant governor, you're, I guess, going to be the decider, because you would be presiding over presumably a still evenly divided state Senate. How would you vote to organize the Senate? Do the Democrats suddenly take the power?
Great question, and you know, that's certainly something that our caucus will talk about. But what the Republicans did in 2011 was unprecedented, when they took people off of committees. And as you know, we won't reorganize committees until 2015, because you need a two-thirds vote to do that. And we just, with a 20-20 split, that won't happen. But what we can do, which I think is pertinent, is that there will be two openings on the Health and Education Committee in the Senate, and we can put two Democrats in those seats and at least stop the social agenda that rolled into Richmond 2 years ago, the transvaginal ultrasound bill, the trap laws, the personhood bill. They've got no business coming into our body of legislation in Virginia. So we'll be able to at least stop that, and then, you know, we'll talk about power sharing and what will happen in 2015 after that.
State Senator from the Norfolk area and Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Ralph Northam. Dr. Northam, thank you so very much for making time for us today on Virginia Insight.
Thank you all so much for having me on. I wish all your audiences to have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Once again, Dr. Northam's Republican opponent, E.W. Jackson, was also invited to be with us earlier today. His press secretary told us he thought that Reverend Jackson would probably not be able to make it, but we did give him our call-in number just in case, and we got half an hour to go, so who knows what could happen. We have three politics watchers with us as our analysis panel today. Speaking to us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the man who heads up the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson. Here next to me in the Insight studio, James Madison University political scientist Bob Roberts. And speaking with us by phone, White House correspondent for the McClatchy Newspaper Group, Anita Kumar. I'm Tom Graham. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Open for anything and everything about politics. If you want to give us a call, In all numbers, we are at 888-967-2825, and we're perfectly happy to jump around, as we always do here. We started with the government shutdown, the looming debt ceiling debate. We went to state politics. We'll go to some other stuff. If you hear something that we've gotten past and you want to go back, we're always happy to go in circles. Susan in Lyndhurst may just do that for us. Susan, thanks for calling in. Your question, your comment, please.
Hi, good afternoon. My comment is, I'm one of these kind of second-tier people. I don't work for the government. However, the government shutdown significantly affects my income. And I don't feel that those of us that are in that position are being counted or even considered by the impact that this shutdown is having on us financially. And it's pretty devastating. I guess along with that, the confusing part to me is, the Republicans seem to be tying it to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, and it's a law that was voted on and passed. Supreme Court has upheld, and because they haven't gotten their way in any step of the process, it seems that we're being held hostage by that. And it's very frustrating as a citizen to see this happen, and certainly how it affects my income as well.
Susan, can you give us a little bit more detail about that? You say that you're not a government worker, but the kind of work you do is affected by the government shutdown. So tell us a little bit about the kind of work you do.
Well, I'm involved in tourism into D.C. and such. And as you well know, right now with everything shut down, everything tourism-wise in D.C. is shut down as well. So it significantly affects me.
Anita Kumar, how much do you have a sense that Republicans in Congress are concerned about their reputation with private business people who say they're being negatively affected by the government shutdown?
Oh, I think that Democrats and Republicans have been sort of acknowledging that it's just not just federal workers. We mentioned before contractors, but there's so many people, particularly in our area in Virginia and Maryland, that are affected by the federal government being closed or somewhat closed. That, I mean, I think that people are aware, but unfortunately, that's still not prompting them to act. But she is correct that this is, the Republicans are tying this shutdown to the Affordable Care Act, the new health care law that just started to go into effect last week. They want some changes, or they want to delay, and they want to tie those two things together, and that's what the president does not want.
Bob Gibson, I specifically ask Anita about Republicans' attitudes to questions from people like Susan, because we tend to think of Republicans as being most concerned about business people, that that's sort of their base. Do you have a sense that if the business community starts to turn against this government shutdown, that that will force Republicans to rethink their position?
I think it'll force all sides to be a little bit more serious about coming to an agreement to end the shutdown. Right now, it's an ideological argument that has been planned. The New York Times had a story Sunday that showed how many months this thing has been planned by conservative think tanks and interest groups that, you know, like Americans for Prosperity, that are the Koch brothers are funding, that basically are planning to attack Obamacare regardless of the cost to the economy because they think they can win the ideological argument with the American people. But if there are economic fallouts that are greater than this ideological argument against Obamacare, then I think a good number of the Republicans in the House may reconsider their support for this shutdown.
Yeah, but throughout this shutdown, the polls have indicated that the vast majority of the American people are not viewing Obamacare as that disastrous. Because it doesn't affect, believe it or not, Obamacare does not affect the vast majority of Americans who are already covered by insurance of some type. And therefore, the idea that somehow you're going to get this grassroots rebellion against Obamacare made no sense whatsoever, because Obamacare really is not that big of a deal for the vast majority of American people.
I will pipe in and say that since last Tuesday when you could start to sign up, which is what happened on October 1st, there have been, or at least here in Washington, there's been a million,
right,
reports. There have been a lot of technical problems on the website, healthcare.gov, and we've seen some stories, particularly like I just saw something from Maryland, a lot of people having trouble signing up or logging on, and the administration will not say how many people have signed up.
Right, but that doesn't see the issue that Bob was talking about in terms of a grassroots rebellion of voters swarming Washington to say get away with Obamacare. The example that so many people want to sign up supports Obamacare because the other stories that have been coming out are the pent-up demand for insurance. There's a lot of pent-up demand for affordable insurance without pre-existing conditions. So I'm not sure where they got this idea that there was this huge grassroots opposition to Obamacare. I don't know.
Well, the polls do show that people do not like it. I mean, I'm not saying it's overwhelming, but it's negative.
They don't like it. But when you ask them, are you willing to shut down the government? Are you willing to not extend the debt? The numbers are overwhelming against
right.
it.
I would agree with that.
I want to get back to another part of Susan's question, if I could. And Susan, please correct me if I'm paraphrasing what I thought I heard from you incorrectly. But my sense was Susan is saying this is a law that was passed by Congress. It was found constitutional to the surprise of some by the U.S.
Right.
Supreme Court. And then there was a national presidential election where the law was a major difference between the two candidates. And the guy named Obama, for
right.
whom the law is named, won the election. So shouldn't that be the end of it? And the Republicans in the House of Representatives, particularly the Tea Party coalition in the Republican
right.
caucus, are saying, no, that should not be the end of it. It seems to me that Susan is saying, is that fair? My guess, Bob Roberts, is that you would say, yes, it is fair because a minority has the opportunity, the way our government is set up, to try and get its way.
I would have to disagree. What has happened in with the Republicans under the whole Hastert rule, which is fairly new, the rule that has come out under the Republican rule, and the Democrats may have used it in the past, I'm not familiar that they did, is that unless there is a majority of Republicans going to vote for a bill, I, as a speaker, will not put the bill up. In other words, I'm not going to put up a bill that might pass the Congress with majority, so overall majority support, but without support of my party. If you have such a rule, it leads to this type of disaster. In a sense, it leads to a situation where a small number of one party can hold the Congress hostage. And that is not what the Founding Fathers intended. I guarantee they did not.
And that small majority, perhaps 80 or 90 Tea Party Republican congressmen, are from districts that are so red that they will never be held individually responsible by their electorate, by their home districts, because their home districts are so gerrymandered
right.
to be so strongly of one party that they only face a defeat if they aren't Republican and Tea Party enough.
Right.
In a primary. They have no challenger who could possibly beat them in November. So they aren't worried about the fairness of this to the overall electorate. They are playing to the base of their party, and the base of their party does not like Obamacare one bit and wants to defund it by any means it can if it can get away with this kind of shutdown to force the leverage to get some sort of concession out of the administration. Now, that doesn't appear likely to happen. But again, we get back to redistricting reform.
I agree.
I think this problem is going to happen again and again and again in Washington until we have a different kind of redistricting that does not create all of these all red, super red districts and super blue districts with no meeting in the middle.
That's correct.
You hear the music.
Yeah.
Susan, you really got us going. Thank you so much for doing that. I hope we've addressed your question.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We got to pause for the break. I think we've got Sandra in Penn Laird and Shad in Charlottesville among our coming calls, but we've also got a couple lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. If you've got anything political you'd like to talk about, we're going to be back in a bit more than 1 minute. To you on the other side of your radio. There are three statewide offices to be decided on November 5th in Virginia: governor, lieutenant governor, and state attorney general. So what have you heard about any of those campaigns that's stuck with you? Have you decided who you are going to vote for or even whether you will vote? And oh, if you've decided you're going to stay home on Election Day, we'd like to hear your thinking about that, too. By phone, we're at 888-WMRA-TALK. On Facebook, you can reach us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Our analysis panel, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, former newspaper reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department's Bob Roberts. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and in Charlottesville, we have Chad joining us. Chad, thanks for doing that. Your question or comment, please.
Hey, thank you very much. A interesting topic to me that was just recently brought up, and I'd like to see it expanded a little bit, has to do with the number of people who are actually going to be affected by the Affordable Care Act. My understanding from looking at data from the Kaiser Family Foundation is that approximately 50% of the population receive insurance through their employer. About another 30% receive it through a government program, Medicare, Medicaid, the VA. 5% are individuals like myself who have to go out on the open market, and they're about 16% insured. So really what we're talking about in the Affordable Care Act is the 16% uninsured and then the 5% like myself who now have an option to buy private insurance.
Correct.
And you know, I think it's worth discussing a little bit more, because when you hear politicians who are against the Affordable Care Act, they always talk about the American people being against it. Well, what percentage of the population is against it who are actually going to be affected by it, number one? And number two, here in the state of Virginia, because the current governor and state legislature did not expand Medicaid, we're still going to have 500,000 people who, even under the Affordable Care Act, will not have access to insurance. And I really would like to hear a little bit more about you know, the politics of that, because you know, again, I represent, according to these statistics, 5% of the population who now will be able to shop in a marketplace. 50% already have access to insurance.
Chad, hold on for just a second. I was having just a little bit of trouble hearing Chad because our cell phone connection isn't the greatest. But Anita, I wanted to check and see if you could hear Chad clearly enough.
I didn't quite catch the latter part of that, so I didn't.
All right, so then I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to respond to what you couldn't hear. Bob Roberts, you had a comment.
Yeah, I have to agree with the caller because, in fact, if we don't expand Medicaid in Virginia, you're going to have about 400,000 individuals who will not have access to subsidized health care under this plan. They can go on the exchanges, but they're not going to get subsidized. So I think that helps to explain that in fact, to most Virginians, this is not a major issue. Now, if you go back to 2010, the Republicans made robbing Medicare a cornerstone of their attack against Obamacare, that somehow it was going to take all this money out of Medicare. And it scared a lot of elderly Americans who came out in the polls and voted against the Democrats. But since then, I think if you surveyed any Medicare recipient in this country, they haven't seen any impact whatsoever. And therefore, this notion that Obamacare is going to have a tremendous impact upon the lives of the vast majority of insured individuals is not the case. And I think that's well established, but it doesn't mean you can't try to persuade people that it will have a tremendous impact.
Bob Gibson, our man at the Sorensen Institute, who is now dedicated, after all your years of covering politics, to trying to get people from different political viewpoints talking to each other respectfully. Would that be a fair description of what the Sorensen Institute is about, Bob?
That's a good part of what we're about, yes.
So I have heard political analysts say, I have not actually heard any Republicans say this, but I've heard political analysts over the past few days claim that there were some Republicans, particularly Republican members of Congress, who were saying that they have to do everything possible to kill the Affordable Care Act that they call Obamacare, to kill it now, because after it's in place for a few months, it'll be too popular to kill. Is that a fair analysis of what some Republicans have been saying?
Yes, and I think there is something to that. Right now, it's very unpopular, the Affordable Care Act, among a great number of people who aren't affected by it. And it's somewhat popular among people who are potentially affected by it, especially if they find out that they can get insurance at a decent price. I think to question one thing that Bob Roberts just said, I think there will be some subsidized health care for those on the exchanges if they're at 130% of
correct.
The poverty
level, but not below. If they're eligible for Medicaid. And then
right.
what I meant was that if you're eligible for Medicaid, you can't go on the exchanges if you're not above that 139.
Right. So I think Obamacare stands a chance of being more popular a year from now than it is now, but we don't know that yet.
Chad, thanks so much for a great question. We're going next to Penn Laird. Sandra, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for Anita Kumar, Bob Gibson, and or Bob Roberts.
I would like to suggest that the lack of popularity for the Affordable Health Care Act is simply an appearance, and it exists because the people who think they don't like this don't really have any experience with it because it wasn't in existence, practically speaking, and they've been listening to the ministers of their political religion. That is, the ministers of that religion being Republican and telling people that this isn't a socialist idea, therefore it's anti-American and anti-democratic. And to me, it's as simple an explanation as that. It has nothing to do with the contents or the benefits of the Affordable Health Care Act. It is strictly Tea Party-type religion, fundamentalist religion and politics, and that's it. I'd also like to know how on earth we're going to get out of this gerrymandering lockhold that we are in if the people who created it to begin with are the ones that are going to be voting on it. We can't seem to get them to change anything else. How on earth are we going to convince them that this is a terrible idea?
This is Bob Roberts.
On
the gerrymandering, I don't think you can get out of that because the no party wants to give away with their power.
Yeah, but some states
There are four states that have, and one of them did it legislatively. Iowa did it legislatively and has competitive elections in every district.
Oh, I agree.
That's after the Iowa legislature became so upset at plan after plan after plan being rejected in the courts because they were so gerrymandered. They finally threw up their hands and said, we're going to have a nonpartisan bunch of folks decide the lines, and they have congressional districts that are competitive every time. Now, Virginia could do that, but it would require a great deal of citizen education, voter education, and a lot of pressure being brought to bear against the House of Delegates majority that currently favors drawing their own districts
to great partisan advantage. There was real pressure this last time. I mean, real pressure. Even a governor who claimed he was for an independent way to do this, and it didn't happen at all. It happened the same old way that it always has happened.
Right.
I mean, and that's not a Republican thing or a Democratic thing. It's whoever's in charge wants to do, you know, wants to save their own.
They want to keep their power.
Yeah,
do I understand correctly that in the last election, where members of Congress who now hold their seats were elected, that although we have a Republican majority in the House, that if you tally up the total number of votes that went to Democratic candidates for Congress and the total number of votes that went to Republican candidates for Congress, the Democrats got about 4 million
more
votes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which
says something about the power of redistricting if you can have many Republicans.
Absolutely. And Iowa, I grew up in Iowa, and the political culture in Iowa is a lot different than a lot of states. I mean, it's been somewhat of a more moderate state. It may be conservative, but moderate state. In the South, where you've had one party rule until fairly recently, until the 1960s, it's very, very difficult to get the established political parties to give up the dominance. In a lot of states that are red, very, very red in this country, they're not going to give it up. Even though they may think it's a good thing, they're not going to do it.
But as Anita says, there are plenty of places in the country where Democrats are controlling the redistricting, and they maintaining their power as well.
They do the same
thing. You've got us focused on a fascinating topic. Thank you so much for doing that. But I do need to move a little bit into something I promised early on, and that was some more discussion of the latest polls in the Virginia race. These two polls, the first ever poll from Hampton University came out a few days ago, and about the same time, a poll by the University of Mary Washington. Bob Gibson, are you familiar enough with this stuff that you can name numbers off the top of your head, or should I just read off the numbers in front of me?
Go ahead and read them. I think generally the idea is that among the entire electorate, there's a significant lead for Terry McAuliffe over Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican, but among likely voters, it's much closer.
Among likely voters, according to the Hampton University poll, McAuliffe is up 5 points over Cuccinelli, which is a little beyond the margin of error. The University of Mary Washington poll shows McAuliffe ahead a little bit more by about 7 points. However, Mr. Gibson is absolutely on target. Among registered voters in the Mary Washington poll, McAuliffe has at least a 10-point lead.
Right.
So what does that say, Bob Gibson, about the number of people who are saying, you know, I really would rather this guy be governor than this guy, but I'm not really going to bother to vote?
Well, it points to the fact that every year we have a governor's race, the year after a presidential election, we have a completely different electorate.
Right.
And instead of a 70% turnout as we had last year, we're going to have about a 40% turnout, which is what we had 4 years ago when Bob McDonnell won the governorship. So with a 40% turnout, a lot of voters who are younger, who are minority, who are newer voters, are not going to be as likely to turn out and vote November 5th this year as they were last year. It's going to be an older and more white electorate and more conservative. So Ken Cuccinelli has a much closer race on his hands among likely voters than he does among all voters, but all voters aren't going to vote. We know that.
But the McAuliffe...
Oh, and it was bad of me not to mention that the Libertarian candidate is a significant factor in both of these polls, anywhere between 7 to 10 points in recent polls he's shown pulling out. But Bob Roberts, it's your view that people who say in the polls that they're going to vote for the Libertarian candidate, the overwhelming majority of them, when they actually get to a polling place, are going to vote for either a Republican or a Democrat.
In the past, that has happened. This may be different. They may be so alienated that they will go home or they won't vote. I think if you look at all these polls, the entire fall campaign, one thing that strikes me more than anything else is the gender gap. Among likely voters, there is in some of these polls as much as a 20% gender gap, and these are women in their 20s, 30s, 40s. That if Cuccinelli loses, and I'm not saying he will, that will cost him the election, the gender gap. In other words, that for whatever reason, the McAuliffe campaign succeeded in basically, and the Northam campaign. And the Herring campaign is creating an impression in the minds of women voters or a majority of women voters that Cuccinelli and the Republican ticket is hostile to women.
Let me mention briefly about the down ticket races that also show up in this poll. In both cases, the race for lieutenant governor and the race for Virginia State Attorney General are quite close in most of the numbers from both of these polls, with one exception. So in the race between Senator Northam and Reverend Jackson for lieutenant governor, it's either a dead heat or within the margin of error, depending on which poll you look at. And in the attorney general's race between State Senator Mark Obenchain and Senator Mark Herring, it's pretty much the same, except for the Mary Washington poll, which shows Republican Obenchain opening up about a 6-point lead over Democrat Herring. So we talked about this the last time we got you guys together. It looks like the Republicans' best chances for holding a statewide office this year is the attorney general's race. Bob Gibson?
I fully expect Mark Obenchain, the Republican candidate for attorney general, to lead his party's ticket this November. I think he's far less controversial than either of his running mates, and he has a longer record of public service, and people know him better. And also, Virginia has a tradition in recent elections of voting Republican for attorney general, despite who wins for governor or lieutenant governor. So I think the odds are that Mark Obenchain will lead the GOP ticket.
Bob Roberts, you had a surprise question for Anita Kumar?
Oh, no.
We got about 60 seconds left.
You always do this. Okay.
Yeah, usually I'm the one. I don't know what he's going
to
ask.
To do about,
so it's going
to
be a surprise for me, too. You got 60 seconds for question and answer.
The scholars are arguing the president should use the 14th Amendment to basically expand the debt ceiling. Have you heard any whisperings that the White House might seriously be considering doing that?
I have heard the exact opposite. They have announced publicly and privately that they have looked into it, and they legally do not believe they have the authority to do it.
Okay.
I would be shocked if it was anything else. They've been really adamant about that point.
Okay, because it's come back and back.
Wow, that was quick and to the point. Yes, I got 30 seconds left.
I knew the answer. I was happy.
Yeah,
so
but now my question is, who's going to take a shot at making predictions for how the November election is going to turn out in Virginia?
Ooh, you know I don't do well on
the predictions. I don't do those this year.
Bob Gibson?
Not me.
I think the 45 members of the House of Delegates who are unopposed are all going to win.
Okay, our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, as well as McClatchy Newspaper's White House Correspondent and Charlottesville native Anita Kumar. Many thanks, team, for making time for us once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anita, you don't sound sure that you really...
That I
mean it.
My question was nice.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you get to that page, you will find links to more information about Bob, Anita, and Bob and the work they are doing. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.